Welcome to another episode of After the Credits. I am your host, Marine Antunes, and this is not your typical podcast. So this is technically a bit of a cheat. We didn't actually record a show with anyone, but I had the great pleasure on Friday night of attending the VIF Forum special event, One Last Cook, with Vince Gilligan, the executive producer and showrunner and creator of Breaking Bad, which will have its series finale on Sunday night. And he showed his favorite episode, which happens to be, I think it's season 4, episode 13, Face Off, the one where Gus Fring gets exploded. We'll leave it at that. Maybe that should have been a little bit of a spoiler warning, but I expect that at this point everybody has seen the show. Vince Gilligan and Damon Lindelof, the writer of various films and co-creator of Lost, was on hand to host the evening, and we managed to capture the audio, all 90 minutes of it. It kind of starts a little awkwardly right at the beginning because Lindelof started talking right off the bat and I just wasn't ready to press record, but we'll leave you with the audio of that conversation. Be sure to stay tuned to row3.com for further updates from VIF. And that's all at the moment. Enjoy the show.
Awesome questions from you guys and also people on Twitter and Facebook as well that I'll sort of intersperse throughout the evening. I'm going to try to ask a lot of the questions that I would want to know as a fan, but also, I'm very curious about the process. And I don't want to, I never ask a magician how they do their tricks, but I do feel like I did buy you a couple cocktails. And let's be honest, I expect something in return. I'm gonna read a quote from the pilot. I think that's a good way to start, because a lot of the times you look at the pilot of a show and you see the mission statement for that show and everything that's gonna follow, beautifully summed up in a very artistic and wonderful way. And Walter says this. He's in a classroom. He says, you see, technically chemistry is the study of matter, but I prefer to see it as the study of change. Electrons change their energy levels, molecules change their bonds, elements combine and change into compounds, but that's all of life, right? It's the constant, it's the cycle, it's solution, dissolution. Just over and over and over, it is growth, then decay, then transformation. It is fascinating, really. And I think, as I revisited the pilot and watched it again, I saw that scene and I was sort of struck by, wow, he's pitching himself. He's telling us what's about to happen to him. And I guess that's kind of my first question for you is, how cognizant of that were you, when not just writing the pilot, but writing that speech, this is what we're going for. This guy is going to change drastically.
That indeed was the the mission statement that he gives in that moment, and that was the one constant throughout the life of this series. It was the thing that got me interested in telling the story in the first place, and it was the self-imposed mandate or franchise, if you will, that we had from the start, and that is that this is going to be a show about transformation. And this is going to be a show in which the main character, through sheer force of will, transforms himself from the good guy into the bad guy. And that was one of those nice moments in the writing of the script where it was possible to indeed let this guy give his own mission statement, so to speak. That was not something I had boarded out or planned out. It's just one of those nice moments you find in the writing where you realize you can. And in one of those moments, actually, you think, gee, am I being too naked in this moment? Am I being too on the nose? But it felt right.
And when you wrote it, were you just like, fuck? A little bit? You deserve it. I'm just going to, we're going to get the elephant out of the room kind of right out of the gate, because I think that, obviously, it's Christmas Eve, and and Christmas Eve, you're like, can I just open one present? So I'm going to ask one question really about the finale, at least the story, and just one, and obviously no spoilers, but this is a fact. Walt, he has an M60 now in his possession. You know, it's fact.
Yes, M60 machine gun. Bell-fed machine guns, yes.
Fact. You've always said that Walt's trajectory is Mr. Chips to Scarface, correct?
Correct.
So my question is, are we going to hear Walt in the finale say hello to my little friend? Yes or no, you gotta tell us now. I wanna know.
Hey, you wanna know, Mr. Gatsby?
I wanna know.
All right, no, you will not hear us. It would have been a good line, though. I wish I had thought of that.
Before I get to the first couple fan questions, you're, and I mean this seriously, you're this really wonderful, sweet, kind of kind, self-effacing, humble, benevolent. You talk all about how everybody else contributes to the show. There's not a maniacal bone in your body. You're just a good human being. Do you think you could break bad? Do you think that there is a circumstance where you could do terrible things?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I do. I mean, I appreciate the kind words. It's funny, in a lot of press, a lot of interviews that Bryan Cranston does, he says that he believes everyone, given the right, or perhaps you could say the wrong set of circumstances, everyone can break bad. Everyone has the capacity to kill. And the first time I heard him say that, I thought, man, does he really think that? And then I think what he's saying is we're all human, which goes without saying, and humanity has within it the highest highs and the most selfless abilities, and it has the lowest, you know, feet of clay kind of nadirs, is that the word? And it just, we all, given the right a certain particular set of circumstances, whether it's defending our family or whether it's, I don't know, I mean, we all can reach those moments, those depths of rage and whatnot. And yeah, I guess we all, I mean, I think, you know, and that's the fact that most of us don't do those, the fact that most of us do not break bad, that most of us instead care about our neighbors and care about our families and care about our countries, be they wherever they are, beautiful Canada or the United States or anywhere in the world, you know, I think most of us are people of goodwill and good intent, and I think that's the hopeful, you know, thing I take away from that. But I think it's all within us, you know, given the wrong set of circumstances.
It does feel, that said, that there are certain characters in the show who have been presented with, you know, this opportunity, this choice, this moment to basically veer left or turn right, and they don't break bad. Like Hank, for example. So is it possible that you're wrong?
Absolutely possible, Ryan. Like, by the way, that's the kind of thing I'd like to be wrong about.
Yeah.
I mean, and to paint a complete picture, or as much as we can in our limited, you know, 47 minutes a week for 62 episodes, we have to show, you know, Walt is obviously a guy who is willing to go to the depths and be very bad indeed. But then we need to counterbalance that with people like Hank and people like Walter Jr. And Jesse, I think, has a soul as a wonderful person who is.
Hey, you know who else has a soul? Gail. Gail has a soul.
Yeah.
Not anymore, though. Just saying.
Well, that's true. You got me there.
some questions from Twitter. This is a tweet from @MollyFaraday, whose name is Molly Faraday. If you had to pick one moment or line as the defining point for the series, what would it be? I know that's a very hard question. But could you try to answer it, because Molly asked?
Gosh. Well, the line I keep hearing quoted back all the time is, I am the danger or I am the one who knocks. And that was fun to hear that one repeated back so much. I was actually in a store on Granville Island just yesterday, this very cool hip store with a lot of fun items, and there was a t-shirt that said, I am the one who knocks. And that was awesome. And completely unlicensed, so... I call the Sonar lawyers and have them shut down. That's fun seeing that one. I actually love seeing that kind of stuff. Licensed or not. And I guess the moment that people, I don't know, it depends on what season we're talking, but all that stuff coming through the ceiling, you know, the bathtub melting through, that was awesome. A high light or a low light. And I guess maybe Walt watching Jane expire and not lifting a finger to save her, that was one of those key moments, I guess.
I love how you talk about that moment like you didn't make it out. He's heartless. This question kind of dovetails into my next line of questioning because I feel like at the end of life, your life flashes before your eyes, at least that's what they say. And I do think it's worth revisiting the beginning. I do want to talk about the pilot and the creative process around the meeting of the show. But just to kick it off, this question is from Andrew Gatt from Facebook. And I don't know if that's a male or a female. They ask, do you remember when and how you came up with the concept for Breaking Bad?
Yes, I was on the phone to a buddy of mine named Tom Schnells, who is a guy, one of my oldest friends. I've known him since 1986 when he and I went to New York University Film School together. And he wound up being a writer along with me on The X-Files, which we shot here in Beautiful. Also, by the way, I want to give a shout out to today is the 125th birthday of Stanley Park. Today is September 27th, 1888. Yeah. But I digress. So I'm talking to my buddy Tom one day in 2004, and X-Files had ended in 2002, and we were 2 years out from that job that we both loved very much. That was a very close second as far as favorite jobs go for me with Breaking Bad being first. But at that point in time, we had been basically unemployed for 2 years, and we were talking about now what do we do for a living? You know, do we greet people entering the door at Walmart?
You're very good at that.
I think I'd be good at something other than this one job. But he said, I don't know why it came up exactly, but something to do with an article in the New York Times about meth labs. But he suggested we put a meth lab in the back of an RV and drive around America and make money. And you have to understand Tom to understand his sense of humor. He was joking. But in that moment, and I've seldom had this kind of a moment in my life. You have that sort of Archimedes in the bathtub kind of eureka moment where it's like this character kind of popped into my head. And in hindsight, I think what intrigued me about him was these were two schlubby middle-aged guys talking about being criminals. And it occurred to me, I'd be interested to see an exploration of a character like me or like Tom, who, for whatever force is driving him, would break bad, would become a bad guy. And I thought that was very interesting, and that was the genesis of the idea in that phone call.
There's a rumor out there that you've actually been manufacturing real meth while making the show. So is that? Is that happening?
If that were true, we would have been on budget.
Yeah. going back to the pilot, can you just talk us through, now that we've got the inception of the idea, a little bit about the origin of the show, the writing of the script, setting up at AMC, resistance that you may or may not have met, as you told other people this Archimedes, this idea of like, oh my God, like I just had this amazing idea. What was the resistance and what was your response to it? Because in my opinion, like nothing great has ever existed without someone saying, that's the stupidest thing that I've ever heard and it'll never work. I was one of those people. And what were the struggles to kind of get to the moment that you were standing on the set and you're calling action on the first day of photography?
You know, in hindsight, I mean, and by the way, every movie you've ever seen, good or bad, and every TV show you've ever seen, good or bad, has a story behind it, I guarantee you, of I mean, I suppose there are exceptions, but most all of them have the history of all the people who said no to it. And obviously, all it takes is the one right person at the right time to say yes. Having said that, I've pitched a lot of ideas over the 20-some years I've been doing this, movies, both in movies and TV, that I thought were a lot more immediately palatable and sellable, whatever the word is, that nobody said yes to. So all of that long-winded preamble to say, selling this, surprisingly, as odd an idea as it is, as out there an idea for a TV show as it is, was not that hard, really. There were not that many places to sell it to. In the U.S. TV industry in 2005, there were really only three potential buyers as we saw it. There was HBO, and there was Showtime, and there was FX. We did not even think of going to any of the four broadcast networks because we just knew this show was too dark and weird and kind of R-rated, and you know, the whole meth angle. It would have been a waste of their time. It would have been a waste of our time. We ultimately got passed on very, very nicely by most of those folks that I mentioned that we pitched to. And I thought this thing was better than a doornail. And then the AMC network came along, and one of my agents called me up and said, hey, you know, this thing that you thought was dead, you're Breaking Bad thing. I took the liberty of sending it to the AMC network. You heard of them? I said, yeah, AMC network. That's the channel that shows, you know, that shows Porky's 2 over and over and over again. And I said, why would you do that? He said, I said, why don't you, you know, just send it to the Food Network? Because it's a good And he said, AMC is gearing up to do scripted original programming. They've got something, I don't know what it's about, something called Mad Men, that is about to...
I haven't heard of that.
Yeah. None of us have heard of it at the time, and of course it turned out to be an absolute phenomenon, as we all know, and a great show. And that was AMC's first Grand Slam home run right out of the gate. At their first at-bat, I guess it's the proper sports analogy. And then they bought Bone Mill, they bought us, they bought Breaking Bad. And in hindsight, it does not seem it was that hard. I don't have a wonderful, dramatic, woeful tale of hard-fought victory. It was not that hard compared to some other pitches I've given along the way.
Do you remember the first scene of the show that you shot? You directed it, obviously, but what was the very first scene you shot chronologically?
The first scene we shot in the pilot, my first day of directing, it was a very big day, and we sort of knew we were not going to make it. We were sort of overscheduled. We were too ambitious. I was very worried about starting off and failing to meet the schedule on the first day, but it was the sequence in the pilot where Walt is wearing the goofy white bulletproof vest and he's sitting in the back of Hank's car and he's witnessing the meth bust. And it's the scene when he first lays eyes on Jesse Pinkman when Jesse falls off the roof. So we had to shoot that entire sequence in one day. The preamble, the guys, Gomi and Hank talking to Walt in the car, and then the school bus going by, and then the guys, the DEA guys on the black excursion hanging on the running boards, driving up and busting, kicking the door in, and then Walt sitting there by himself and watching Jesse Pinkman fall off the roof. And it was a long day. But I think the first shot was the three guys in the car having the preamble before the bust went down. And I was scared out of my mind. I mean, I had directed before, but only twice, only two episodes of X-Files. And I was just thinking, man, I cannot fail. This we could bring down this entire fledgling network. Let's be a little dramatic. I don't know if that would have been the case. But it would have been embarrassing. It would have been humiliating. So.
You mentioned Jesse and... And I think probably for all of us who have followed the show religiously, we've all heard that the original plan was that Jesse wasn't going to survive the first season. And I'm curious, the obvious question is what, you know, why'd you change your mind? But I think that the answer is obvious as well, which is that Aaron is incredible, and obviously his chemistry with Brian was even more so. But I'm not sure that I've ever heard you be asked how he was going to be kicked. You know, what was there, other than just the arbitrary, yeah, we're gonna kill this guy off, but had you talked at all about how it was gonna happen and who was gonna do it?
We didn't nail it down completely, but it probably would have played out something along the lines of Tuco Salamanca. Might have been him, for instance. The best pitch I had was he was going to die in a horrifically cinematic manner, but I never figured out exactly how. But it would have been unpleasant, and it would have, and you know, for those of you in the audience who are writers, you can probably tell where we're coming from when we talk about some of this stuff. That's a bit of a schematic in a writer's sense. That's a bit of a schematic sequence. It's not so much organic as schematic, in the sense of I was thinking ahead, thinking, okay, probably what would be cool is we, you know, we kill off this character. We need him just long enough for him to give Walt his proper entree into the meth business, into the world of criminality, and then he will have served his purpose. And then, in a schematic sense, let's kill him off in a horrifying fashion, so that then that moment can be fuel for Walt. To be angry as hell and want revenge, and that'll propel the plot forward in season two. And you realize once you start casting these parts and working with these actors, you tend to become less schematic and more organic. You start to realize, you know, first of all, look what's right in front of you. This young actor who, you know, by, you know, if there's any justice in the world, is going to be a big star. A crazy act. Let's take this wonderful opportunity we have to explore this character more fully, and not worry about being too overly mechanistic in our storytelling, but just let's explore these characters some more. And that's what I love about TV, the opportunity to explore these things together as a group of people, as a group of collaborators, both in front of the camera and behind it.
And also the things that you need, you find that you don't need, at least in terms of plot. For example, Walt clearly didn't need Jesse to be killed to be angry.
Yes.
He finds it from so many other places. just a brief interview with Grey Matter is enough to get a clenched fist. We actually, since we're flash forwarding from the pilot, and I want to talk about that that narrative device a little bit later. We revisited the pilot at the beginning of Ozymandias, and you know, it's obviously it's a simpler time. We're seeing it was just so shocking to see Walt and Jesse in that phase of their relationship, and then to see Walt call Skylar, and she doesn't know, and she's still selling things on eBay, and he's going to pick up a pizza. And I obviously you put it there to kind of give us a sharp contrast. Also, we're geographically in the same place. But I was just wondering, could you talk us through a little bit what it was like to be back in the RV again after all that time?
That was really interesting on a lot of levels, because that scene, that teaser, was shot on the last day of production. That was obviously the third from the last episode. But that was the very last thing that was shot. And at the end of that sequence, which was directed by Ryan Johnson, okay. I directed the final episode.
By the way, let's give it up for Ozymandias.
Ryan Johnson, if you're not familiar with his work as a movie director, do yourself a favor and rent the movie Brick and The Brothers. He's a brilliant director. And he directed that episode, and that episode was written by Vancouver's own Moira Wally Beckett, who's a great writer from BC. She did a great job. And I finished up directing the final episode, the one that airs Sunday night, the day before, and then we had that pickup, and we had to hold off that teaser until last because it had to do with the hair, the facial hair, to put the beard on properly. No, I'm sorry. No, Walt. I'm sorry. Walt was obviously clean shaven. He just had the mustache. So you really, as amazing as prosthetic makeup is nowadays, there's really no way to cover a beard with like a skinhead wig kind of thing. So Brian had to be clean shaven, and the only time to do that was on the very last day of shooting. So that's why we scheduled it that way. So I had the wonderful pleasure of getting to be in Tahajali, this reservation out 40 miles west of Albuquerque, and I got to hang out on the set and not be needed at all. I just got to hang out with my camera and take pictures of everybody and wander around. Ryan and Moira didn't need me, the cast and crew didn't need me, and that was a wonderful thing. And I just got to be like a tourist on the set, and at the end of that teaser, at the end of that day of shooting, at the end of that sequence, our very thoughtful producers broke out a whole bunch of bottles of champagne, and everybody teared up and hugged each other, and it was a very touching moment I can't speak for anyone else, but I won't soon forget it. It was wonderful.
Some more fan questions. Our contest winners. This question is from Facebook. Vince, you have mentioned that Walter White's arc has been planned from day one. So my question is this. Has the performance of Bryan Cranston allowed you to push the character further than you had planned? And if so, can you offer any examples? And that's from Scott Cucurutz. If you could pronounce it, give it a shot.
Cuckoo.
Thank you, Scott.
Cuckoo.
Scott is available to pop out of the clock.
Excellent question, Scott. Yes and no, I had it planned out, and I'll tell you what I mean by that. Yes, we always had in mind that we were going to take our good guy and turn him into a bad guy. That was a solid plan, and we abided by that for 6 years. We knew we'd take the good guy and turn him into the bad guy. Having said that, that does not mean in any way, shape, or form that I knew plot-wise what was going to happen year after year or even moment to moment within any one episode. I had certain ideas when I was writing the pilot, and even before writing it, when I was pitching the pilot to our studio and our network, I had certain ideas, most of which I've completely forgotten by now, and I would pitch them, and they'd say, oh, that sounds cool. And then what happens in a TV show, you hire writers, and you hope that they're going to be wonderful, and in my case, they were. I had six excellent writers, and we all would sit around together for hours on end and come up with the actual plot moments, you know, the plot beats. And so having said all of that, it was a constant voyage of discovery to figure out what Walt was going to do day in and day out. And the best way we got to those moments was organically, which is to say, you know, it wasn't, oh, wouldn't this be cool if this happened? Wouldn't it be cool if that happened? Admittedly, every now and then we did that, but our finest moments in the writer's room were when we said to ourselves, what does Walt want right now? What's his greatest hope? What's his deepest fear? What's driving him? And therefore, what does he want to do next? And the greatest moments in a writer's room, I found this in The X-Files, writing for Mulder and Scully. The greatest moments were, and this sounds kind of weird if you haven't experienced it, but it really is true. Sometimes the greatest moments are, you don't feel like you're a writer, you feel like you're a court stenographer. And like I'd hear sometimes Mulder and Scully arguing in my head, and I just start typing it down. And
they have pills for that.
Don't
take them, but they exist.
They have this liquid called vodka, is what. Yeah, you've had that experience, haven't you? You
absolutely.
You know what I'm talking
Especially
about?
For all the bad stuff. It was channeled through me.
But it's like, it's a wonderful feeling when the storytelling derives from this organic process. Not to say we didn't cheat every now and then, or, and you know, every now and then we would say, hey, this would be a cool scene with a I don't know, guy's head on a turtle or whatever. How do we get to that? So all of that long-winded way of answering, did Walt ever surprise me? I guess he surprised all of us, organically speaking, when he watched Jane die. I think that came up in the writer's room, and by the way, all these ideas were not mine, but I think that idea was mine. And I think when I pitched it, the other writers looked at me kind of aghast and said, man, I think my first pitch was he doesn't just watch her die and do nothing. I think my first pitch was that he shoots her up with a second dose of heroin. And they were like, you're a sick bastard. And then it wound up being whittled down, and rightly so, to if she starts to choke, what if he did not attempt to save her? Because he's got reasons to not save her. He said that would be very terrible and soul-killing, but on the other hand, it would make his life a whole lot easier in this moment. So that was one of those moments where his darkness surprised us. And it actually was the one moment it surprised the studio and the network. And they were very courageous for 6 years, but that was the one time I can think of where they called up and they didn't wave the red flag, whatever the expression is. They didn't say don't do it, but they did say let's talk about it. They said we don't fear him being this dark and evil. We just fear it happening only 18 or 19 episodes into the run of the series. You know, how much darker can he get from here? So that's a very valid question. And none of us knew at the time just how much darker we could get. I couldn't pitch him what was going to happen later. So that's the fun process. You don't really quite know where you're going.
I was going to ask you about that moment later, but since we're on it now, I just want to say as a fan, and I don't know how many of you guys I speak for, but when we got to that moment in the show, and he's standing there at the foot of the bed, and it's happening, I just remember thinking he's not going to do anything. And I feel like if he had done something to help her, it would have been a betrayal. Like, I wasn't happy about the fact that he wasn't going to do anything. But it felt like in that moment, that had to be what happened. So, at least on my, I guess that makes me a dark fucker too, but, you know, thank you.
No, thank you
for killing Jane. Thank you.
Glad that was
she has a sitcom now. She's doing great.
She does. Kristen Ritter. She's just cute as she can be, too. I love her. She's alive and well. Don't worry about it.
Just choking on her own vomit, as cute as she can be. Another question from Twitter. This is from Ames Boom or Vong. And the tweet was, this is very apropos, actually. How do you decide who you kill off? And who you let live, and what was the hardest death to figure out? And I think that's different than what was the hardest death to actually write or execute. But just in terms of, you know, I would imagine the one that we just watched here was just in terms of the mechanics right up there.
You're absolutely right. The hardest one to figure out was the one you just saw, because this is the guy, Gus Fring, who's arguably the only guy, and there are a lot of smart good guys and bad guys on Breaking Bad, but arguably the smartest cat whoever came down the pike on this show was Gustavo Fring. It's very defensively arguable that he was smarter than Walt, and Walt really had to raise his game in order to defeat this guy. And what you don't want, and again from a writer's point of view, or I'm sure a viewer's point of view for that matter, you don't want your really wonderful, charismatic, brilliant bad guy to suddenly get stupid in the 11th hour just so that the good guy can win. Of course, I use the terms good and bad guy here pretty relatively. but loosely, very loosely I'm using those. But we knew that, you know, everyone has an Achilles heel, and we figured that Gustavo Fring's Achilles heel could not be intellectual, but it had to be emotional. And so we went to the trouble many episodes prior to this one of him, of setting up his rage against the character of Tio Salamanca, played by the wonderful Mark Margolis. And that was, we had to play a deeper game than we were accustomed to, trying to figure all that out. So that was the hardest death to figure out, because it had to be had to be nuts on. It had to be earned. The toughest death for the crew, I can tell you, was Mike Romantrop, played by Jonathan Banks. Tell you that my friend Tom Schnauz, who I was telling this story about earlier about being on the phone with him back in 2004, he wrote and directed that episode. It was the first time since NYU Film School that he had actually directed, and he did a fantastic job. And it was tough. I was not there on the set, but he was telling me there by the Rio Grande there, by the river, wherever all that took place. He said it was a very tough day because the crew kept, Jonathan Banks kept, you know, tearing up. And the crew just loved him. The crew was so tight-knit and wonderful. Somebody in the crew made black armbands or bought them, and everyone's wearing a black armband on the crew that day in honor of Jonathan. And they got the final bit of it just as the sun was going down, just as the sun was about to become, you know, so it was about to be so dark that it'd be unshootable. I wish I'd been on the set more often. I was mostly in the writer's room in Burbank, and the set was where all the fun was happening.
Another question from Twitter. And this is from Adam Grossman. For such a perfectly crafted story, what has been the most unexpected change to how you first envisioned it? That's a tough one. You can pass.
Most unexpected change. Oh man, let me think about that, because you know, that's a great question, but I don't have a great answer for it. Most unexpected.
I think we'll just accept killing Jesse. Well, you know, already stated, unless you, the question, I'm like, Jesus, that's a tough one.
That is, that's a good question. The good ones are the tough ones. What else was unexpected? Well, I tell you, all right, I don't know if it's the most. I have trouble with superlatives. You ask me what my favorite episode is or favorite character. I can't narrow it down to favorites or least favorites or whatever. But one that springs to mind, if this is useful, is that we really loved the character of Tio Salamanca at the end of... we loved him too. Tuco Salamanca, his nephew, crazy guy snorting meth off the tip of a Bowie knife, played by the excellent actor Raymond Cruz. He was our bad guy at the end of season one, at the beginning of season two, and we were going to have all kinds of fun with him. And then unfortunately, and the actor, Raymond Cruz, a great guy, he very much wanted to participate, but he was contractually obligated to the TV series The Closer. So we barely got him shot out in that big episode at the beginning of season two, where he is out in the middle of the boonies with his uncle, with his T.O. in the wheelchair, and then all that sequence with the big shootout with Hank. We barely got that thing scheduled because the folks at The Closer were very nice, but they couldn't break him out very, very much. So the biggest change probably in season two is we were going to have this guy be our bad guy for like 13 episodes straight, and it just would not come to pass. It just couldn't make it happen. So we had to invent another bad guy, kind of on the fly, and that's where Gustavo Fring came from. Gustavo wow. Fring as a bad guy was everything Tuco was not. He was not wild-eyed and crazy and foaming at the mouth and a user of his own product. He was very businesslike and buttoned down and proper and soft-spoken. And of course, as we learned as the series went on, he could be even scarier than a guy like Tuco. So, you know, that's one of those things, you know, sometimes life gives you lemons, sometimes your TV show gives you lemons, and you kind of have to make lemonade, and that was a good example of that.
In the second season of Lost, we had an amazing character, Mr. Echo, who we had plotted, you know, a multi-season arc for and all these great ideas. The actor just did not want to be in Hawaii at all. He was from London, Ottawa, amazing actor. He was like, I'm leaving, like, I'm gone, kill me off, please. So, we were like, no, you can't leave, we have this whole thing worked out for you. But at the same time, we had cast Michael Emerson in the middle of that season, and then And then Ian Cusack, this guy played a character named Desmond towards the end. We're like, we'll just write for those guys and cover our asses. And they ended up, you know, it happened as a direct result of losing Hadiwale. So it is exactly the same situation where people say, like, you know, are you making it up as you go along? You're like, well, when the closer comes a calling, you have no choice.
Michael Emerson, by the way, he was so great on Lost. He's such a fine actor. I worked with him in the last episode of The X-Files I ever wrote and directed. He played this damaged man-child who had these astounding psychic powers, and he loved the Brady Bunch. So he created the world of the Brady Bunch in his own house. And he's a great actor. He's a great guy.
He really is. Another question from Twitter. This is from another great segue. From at dscully 324, and Caroline is her actual name. What for you personally is the most memorable scene in Breaking Bad, and why? Now that you've told us that you don't like to use superlatives, so a very memorable scene that can't be Jane dying because you already used it.
I already used that one. Man. Very memorable scene. Oh man, it's a hard. All right, I'll do this like with the Rorschach test, like what pops into your brain. I'm thinking of the head and the tortoise that pops into my head. That was a fun one. I still have the head, by the way. I've got it in my computer. And it's a perfect life cast of the actor Danny Trejo, and it's cast in silicone, and it smells kind of funky, and it is really creepy to touch because it feels like. I guess I'm never having felt it, thank God, but it feels kind of like corpse skin. And this low-budget movie that had Danny Trejo in it, I guess in the movie he had his head lopped off. They borrowed it from us. So they didn't have to make their own, which I think is very nice of us. But that scene was directed by a gentleman named Felix Alcala, who did a wonderful job with that sequence. And that one always springs to mind. In the writer's room, I was very proud of that moment. I think all of us writers were. We said, okay, human head on a tortoise, big desert tortoise. Man, this is great. This is going to be very iconic. People are going to remember this. Let's all go to lunch. Let's feel good about today. And then George Mastris, one of our writer producers, said, because he always sat like this in the room. And he's with his arms crossed, laying in back, and he says, and then the head should blow up. I said, George, for fuck's sake, man. Like, quit while you're ahead here, man. And then we thought about it. We said, well, George is right. So, if I have the bottom of the scene, might as well be the head blowing up.
Where does one keep Danny Trejo's head? Where is it?
You know, it's... The scariest answer I could give is the true answer, which is I don't quite know at this point. I'm not sure. It's somewhere on my property, somewhere. I'm not sure where. I'd have a hard time putting my hands on Danny Trejo's head at this point.
Okay. We've got, there was a contest for super fans. Breaking Bad, and the prize was that they got to come to this event and ask the question in person. So I believe that we have our two contest winners. Are they here? Are they? Yes, I believe they are. Come on down. We have Guy-Manuel and Phil Johnston. So you come down and ask your questions in person.
That look. You guys are rocking those suits very, very well. Nice.
Your name is, sir?
Hi, I'm Phil.
Phil, have you been watching the show since the very beginning, or did you catch up, or?
It was kind of a catch up. Right around 2012, I caught up to season 4.
And how does it feel to wear the suit?
Oh, it's really warm.
they don't breathe, do they? It's very unpleasant, probably.
So look at, please. Ask Vince your question, and he will answer it.
Oh, hi, Vince. So, my question is related to what drives the character of Walter White. I noticed the slogan for season 5 is "Remember My Name." So it got me thinking that maybe, and it does seem like Walter is driven to be remembered in a way the other characters aren't. So I was thinking, maybe someone in Walter's life forgot about him in a way that he wants to ensure never happens again. So my question is, have you shown us who forgot Walter White in the series so far? And if not, do you have any clues as to who that might be?
That's an excellent question. You know what, I think there's a lot of depth to that question. I think you're right on the money. I don't know, it's an interesting thing when you write a character. It's easy when you write a character to think there's one precipitating moment in a character's life where it all goes right or it all goes wrong. Typically in drama, it's the moment where it all goes wrong. And I think in strictly meat and potatoes dramatic terms, I would have to point to Gray Matter Technologies and Gretchen and Elliot, who we've seen a couple times sprinkled throughout the series, and most recently we saw them in last week's episode on the Charlie Rose Show. But I would offer the thought that that may have been a very important precipitating moment in Walt's life, but it's kind of, in real life we just, and this is not real life, he's a TV character, but I like to think of him sometimes. I like to try to examine him as if he were a real guy, and I think Walt is a guy, I think you're right on the money with a lot of those ideas. Like Walt is a guy who's very prideful and very full of ego. He's got this overweening ego. He's always got to be the best at chemistry, the best at making, you know, crystal meth, the best Heisenberg, the best drug kingpin, because it feels like he missed his opportunity to do something more positive and legitimate with his life. And the real crime of his life, or what he allowed it to become, perhaps, is that he could have had that level of success or something close to it in the legitimate world. He could have been, as he says at one point in our season 5A, he says to Jesse, you know, I could have been part of this 2. Blah blah billion-dollar corporation, Gray Matter, and then the way he sees it, his birthright was stolen from him. I would argue that Walt is the author and engineer of his own miseries, and certainly those of his family. But even before he became a drug kingpin, if he was sleepwalking through life, maybe that's on him and nobody else. Maybe he's not a victim of chicanery or larceny on the part of other people stealing from him. Maybe he stole his own, he robbed himself. He robbed himself of his own happier life he could have had. So, but good question.
So, in other words, you make your own bed, you lie in it, and you choke on your own vomit while somebody watches.
Yes.
Okay, so our next contest winner, your name, can you pronounce it? Is it Dai?
It's Dai.
Dai. And how long have you been watching the show?
Since season 1, yeah. But, I mean, I have to admit that my anxiety levels got really, really high after season 1, and I had to wait for season 2 and season 3 to play out and watch them all at once back to back. Because I just couldn't handle the anticipation between episodes.
How are you feeling right now?
Oh, dude, I am so stressed.
would you feel better if, say, you could sleep with Danny Trejo's head? You could make that happen. Please, Dai, ask your question of Vince.
Sure. I understand why I would be wearing tiny whities under this. I'm wearing clothes under this thing. It's freaking hot.
It's hot.
But, my question was, you know, we all draw inspiration from different things in life, and as someone who's created and fleshed out some incredible characters, extremely memorable, my question was, how many of those characters might be modeled off real people in your life, and do those individuals know?
Excellent.
Another excellent question. not characters per se, but names of characters, most definitely. My girlfriend Holly, first and foremost, who's in the audience somewhere.
Holly, say mama for us.
There she is. And so Holly, of course, is the name of the White's little baby girl. And Holly's brother, Hank, is in real life a clinical pharmacologist who lives in Wilmington, North Carolina.
You guys get along? You and
Hank? And Hank, I use the name because I love the name, but Hank, the real life Hank sounds more like Walter White, but he's not like Walt, and he's not like Hank. So it's just mostly the name and the idea of someone making their living in the sciences. I'm being a little long-winded here, as I tend to be. Those two examples are names, essentially. But the one character who is based on anybody, and I realize this in hindsight, this is embarrassing, is Walt is probably kind of based on me. Not Heisenberg. Not Walt once he became interesting. Walt prior to becoming interesting probably is the closest example I can give you of a character who's based on someone I know. And I didn't even realize this at the time. It's kind of one of those things you realize in hindsight. I realized that I was about to turn 40 years old when I came up with this idea. And I was thinking, man, you know, midlife crisis, that's going to be a tough one. I'm going to have a bad one, probably. And have I done enough with my life thus far? And has there been enough excitement? Have I swung for the fences, you know, and all those kind of things you think of as you approach your rapidly, dwindling, you approach your mortality, whatever the hell I'm trying to say. Walt is a guy who lives in fear until he becomes Heisenberg, until that first episode where the seeds are planted and he realizes he's not in the middle of his rather undistinguished up to that point life. He's at the end of his life and he's going to suddenly make hay while the sun is shining. And that is something I find intriguing because I don't live my life from a place of courage. I live it instead from a place of neuroses and fear. I realized that in hindsight. I realized what it really intrigued me about this character was not that he broke bad, not that he was a criminal, not that he, cooked meth or any of that stuff. That's just set dressing. What really interested me about this guy is he went forward with courage. Unfortunately, he does a great many bad things that none of us could get behind. None of us could say, yay, attaboy. But what he does choose to do, he does with courage. And I think that, at the end of the day, was what intrigued me so much about the character. Even though when I first pitched it to the studio and the network, I couldn't have put that into words. It took me 5 or 6 years of thinking about this guy day in and day out to finally make that simple realization, so.
And if I was your therapist and I was trying to integrate both these questions into one, I would say, who is your gray matter, Vince?
The one thing I've got over Walter White is that
hair?
is that I when I was miserable in high school, when I was miserable in college, when I wasn't, when I was not living my life to the fullest as I saw it, whatever, I didn't blame anybody else. I realized, my problems were of my own authorship, my own devising. The difference between me and Walter White really is that he goes out of his way to blame other people. Gretchen and Elliot or whatever powers it be, he seems to find other people to blame. That's one thing I'm proud of. I don't go looking for other people to, my failings are my own. I take complete ownership of them, so, anyway.
That's awesome. Thank you. No, it is. Thank you for sharing that. Confession for a space like this. And again, a big round of applause for our two super queens. And and as your prize, Todd is waiting in the back to tie you, leash you up, and get you cooking. So congratulations. I do want to have before we continue with the questions, just a brief shout out to the, let's acknowledge the other writers on the show, many of whom have directed episodes as well. And obviously, if you could kind of name them in your answer, that'd be great. But I guess my question is, and this is certainly my experience, there's a hive mind that forms, but each writer kind of has their specialty. It's a little bit of a, you know, an A-team. There's the weapon specialist and the one who won't get on planes. And someone in the room is like, no, Gomi would never do that. He's the Gomi guy. Like, he's speaking up for Gomi. So, if you could just talk a little bit about the different personalities that make up this incredible show, because you acknowledge, you're so gracious. But I also happen to know, in this case, they most of them have been there since the very beginning.
Absolutely. Dating back to the first two hires who were with us the whole time. There's Peter Gould, who, by the way, is going to be appearing at VIFF, at the film festival here next Wednesday. I think he's going to be up on a panel with, what's his name? Rick Cleveland, who's also an excellent writer. That'll be a good one for you guys to attend. Peter Gould, wonderful writer who created the character Saul Goodman, and he and I are gonna work on this. He's great. And Peter's superpower in the room was his. He had several. One of them was he was excellent. Aside from being, they're all wonderful writers. They could all put it on the page. But as you well know, you also want folks who are wonderful in the writer's room and who are constantly helping and sometimes even just paying attention. So, we all have our moments where energy flags in the writer's room or just throw like counting ceiling tiles or whatever. Peter was always a constant cheerleader and always paying attention and always very structurally minded and character minded. Was great in the writer's room and also just buoyed me up when I was very depressed. The thing we always made fun of him, he always said, "Great things are happening." That was his catchphrase. And that was wonderful. I loved having Peter in the room. George Masters, hired at the same time as Peter. George used to be a lawyer and has also backpacked all around the world and really led a very interesting life. Wrote a novel called Fidali's Way, which is an excellent read. So aside from being an excellent writer, George helped us with all the legalese and told us when we were barking up the wrong tree as far as what the DEA could do and couldn't do, vis-a-vis powers of arrest and whatnot, all that kind of stuff. And he wrote some great, hard-boiled, tough guy stuff. He created the character of Tuco Salamanca, and, he's the guy to come up with lines like, he wasn't tight, tight, tight. That was Peter. He was the one who like lines like kicks like a mule with his balls wrapped in duct tape. I remember reading that. Well done. Well done, my friend.
I salute you, sir.
And then we had Sam Catlin, who was one of the funniest people I've ever met. Sam directed for the first time an episode that he wrote a couple episodes back. That was the one in which Walt shows up. I'm drawing a blank on the episode titles now. But, Rabid Dog, where he shows up. Walt shows up, and Jesse's not in the house, but the gasoline spilled everywhere. And Walt spends the rest of the hour being told first by Saul and then by his own wife that you got to kill Jesse Pinkman. And at the end of the hour, he decides to. Sam, funny as hell.
That's hysterical.
No, that's not as funny. But Sam, really, I've never laughed so hard at anyone as this guy. He's just tremendously funny. Came to writing from being an actor and a playwright and then got into screenwriting, as did Moira Wally Beckett from beautiful Vancouver. She started as a ballerina, actually, and then an actress. I think she had a bit part, she tells me. She didn't want me to go see it or rent it, but I think the movie Runaway that was shot up here with Tom Selleck. Michael Crichton movie. I think she was in that.
Gene Simmons is the bad guy in that.
Yeah, Gene Simmons. I had Gene Simmons' head on it, I think. Or maybe I'm making that up. She's very cute. I wouldn't be surprised. and she wrote plays as well. And she and Ginny Hutchison, who used to be my writer's assistant, are two women on the staff, and they both write some of the best hard-boiled dialogue, the best tough guy dialogue. Moira wrote the sequence directed by Michelle McLaren, another BC girl. Michelle McLaren, a wonderful producer-director, who directed the most hardcore, badass, hard-boiled, tough guy sequences, and Moira wrote some of them, some of those hard-boiled sequences. The two of those ladies together wrote and directed the episode with that sequence in it last year, set to the Nat King Cole song where the 10 guys get shivved in jail inside of 2 minutes.
Yep.
And so, man, I wouldn't want to cross the road.
I give it up for Shiv.
Absolutely.
Sick fucks.
And Jenny, who used to be my writer's assistant on The X-Files, I'm so proud of her. She became a staff writer several seasons ago. And gets the voice of Hank, of all people. Absolutely, just nuts on perfect. Before we gave her the staff writing job, she would write, Hank had a blog on the AMC website, and you would read Hank's musings, in other words, week in and week out. And
about
she,
minerals?
About anything and everything, about the state of the nation, you know, about all this stuff. And she would write this stuff, and I would read it and just marvel and say, where are you channeling this from? This is, because, you know, it's just, she's, does a great job with that. Let's see, what did I name all three? One, two, three, four. Who am I missing? And then Tom Schnauss, who I talked about, who's one of my oldest friends, who also one of the funniest people I've ever met, and is great with structure and great in the room. And you know, they were all. It was like murderer's row. I mean, this in the old athletic sense. These guys were all, they were the A-team. They were great.
So a quick speed round of who wrote it. And maybe sometimes these things are hard to remember, writers' rooms, but the memorable ones, you tend to, all the memorable quotes on Lost, I did not write. So I always remember thinking, oh, I wish I'd written that, and therefore it seared itself in my brain. So here's some quotes, and you, hopefully these are not all you, or else it'll feel like I'm kissing your ass even more. But so the first one is, everyone sounds like Meryl Streep with a gun to their head. That's a mic quote.
I think that was Sam Catlin. It was not me. That was, yeah. I think that was Sam. I think it was, pretty sure that was Sam. Yeah, that was a great line.
By the way, do you know who Meryl Streep sounds like with a gun to her head? Sean Connery.
That's true.
Very strange. Here's a Jesse line. And it's actually an exchange between Jesse and Badger and Skinny Pete. Jesse says, what's the point of being an outlaw when you got responsibilities? And then Badger says, Darth Vader had responsibility. He was responsible for the Death Star. And then Skinny Pete says, true that, two of them bitches. Whoever that is, I want to high five them so bad.
Drawn a blank, and that might have been George Masters. I drawn a blank on that.
Excellent.
That
was, yeah. What credit to George? This line you mentioned earlier is now on a T-shirt. So this person is do funds. I'm the one who knocks the whole speech leading up to that.
That was a Ginny Hutchison episode, and that turned out very memorable. Yeah.
Excellent. And my personal favorite, yeah, bitch, magnets.
Yeah.
Yes. And legend has it, you weren't even pitching it as a line. You were just saying it.
Yeah, you know, it's something you say, and then you think, hey, why don't we do an episode about magnets?
Some more questions from the fans. This is a tweet from Art at Art Baccio. And it's sort of presumptive, and again, I don't, please don't spoil anything or even indicate anything about the final episode, but Walt always had seen Jesse as his son. Why did he give up on him in the end? And let's just say that in the end essentially means at the moment where he decides to kill Jesse, Perhaps he's changed his mind. Maybe he hasn't. We don't know. We don't want to know. But in that,
I think Art is talking about that that episode Ozymandias, and that's for my money the nastiest thing Walt has ever done, and he's done a lot of nasty things. Is coldly looking Jesse in the eye, and this is as he pauses Jesse before they put Jesse in the car, ostensibly to take him away and torture him to death, and he's got to twist the knife one last time before he says goodbye forever by saying, I watched Jane die. I could have saved her, but I didn't. Which I think is very arguably the nastiest thing he's ever done. And I think why he does that is, I'm not saying he's right, but I think where his mind is at in that moment is, this kid, he betrayed me. He did the worst thing you could do in our business. He ratted on his partner. This guy ratted me out to my own brother-in-law. And he led my brother-in-law directly to me. He's just a slack-jawed little rat. And now my brother-in-law is dead because of him, because of this little bastard who's cowering under this car. And I'm absolutely the one, and I've just forever, at least in this moment, forevermore, it looks like I'm never gonna be Heisenberg again. I tried desperately to save my brother-in-law. I offered all the money I've ever made in my life in this lousy business. Everything I've bled and sweated and cried for, I offer to give up, and my brother-in-law is now dead, and my money is now gone, and I'm going to get revenge on this kid who I think in this one moment is the author of all my problems. This is sort of like we were talking about a minute ago, and Walt is never the author of his own problems in his mind. So I think that's where that awful, nasty sadism comes from. It's not nice, but I mean, it's earned. Character-wise, in that moment, it felt like to us.
And to us, and it's bold and nuanced and amazing. This is another question from Adam Grossman. And again, if you can't come up with it on the spot. Of all the genius lines, do you have a favorite Saul Goodman line? A moment of Saul's.
Saul has so much comedy gold emanating, falling from his lips. It's hard to nail it down. But I think some of his best stuff was in the very first episode in which he appeared. I think that first sequence when he comes in Peter Gould's episode back in season two, and he just goes on this riff to Badger, who is in trouble for selling meth, and he goes on this 60-second long tear about, here's what you need to do. I need a cashier's check made out in the amount of $4,000, blah, 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 dollars. And we can talk about MasterCard eventually, but never American Express. He's talking about like this. I can't even do it justice. I can't remember all the words, but this amazing riff he goes on. And then Badger, he's not spoken a word about the kid being innocent or guilty or whatnot. And then Badger says, but you're going to get me off, right? And he says, he has another couple funny lines, but then he says, son, you're going to get the best criminal defense that money can buy. And I just thought that was my favorite probably yet. But I just, there's so much gold that comes out of this guy's mouth.
Pure gold. Let's give it up for Bob Odenkirk. Fortunately for all of us, a lot more to come. And I don't want to know anything about the spinoff because I feel a little betrayed. We can probably talk more about that after the final episode. Here's another question from Twitter, from Anjula Rasanga, and they asked, Mr. Gilligan, people around the world idolize you as a cult TV god, thanks to piracy, downloads, and streaming. What's your take on this? Now, I'm unclear as to what's your take on being a cult TV god or piracy in general, but let's go with piracy. Like, I mean, obviously, the show has benefited from it. You're in the zeitgeist. There was a massive, unprecedented, ratings uptick in terms of when the show came back for this final run. How do you feel about it?
You can't help but feel ambivalent. You can't help but feel good and bad. I was in Galway, Ireland about 3 years ago at a very nice little film festival, film forum there. And everybody in the room was asked if they had seen, the moderator said, how many people, everyone would see a show of hands, how many people have seen Breaking Bad? And every hand in the room went up. And then the moderator said, okay, how many people didn't pay to see it, but downloaded it illegally, and every hand went up. And this very funny Irish writer on the panel with me said, you know, people ask me, they say, you know, don't you feel bad about piracy? I mean, you wouldn't steal a Cadillac, would you? And he said, if I could download it into my computer, I would. And it's one of those things, you know, listen, I'm not gonna lie, I'm only human. I wish that all those people had you know, paid for it so I could get my 0.00003 cents per download, you know, but, or whatever it is. But on the other hand, it's absolutely true. If that's what it takes to get a show like this known throughout the world, then that is a, I don't know if you can say it's a necessary evil, but I mean, it's a, you know, I can't hate it. I gotta be happy about it. So, well, like I say, I'm on Granville Island yesterday, and I see a T-shirt. It's and I just, the first thing I do is smile, because I'm like, man, I'm so glad this is so embedded in the zeitgeist. I don't care how it got there, you know. But you know, it's a complex issue, because it's not just the guys on, you know, the guys front and center. It's you know, all this kind of stuff trickles down to crews, to the below the line folks, and all this. You know, it's a complicated issue, but I, you know, I'm just glad that people know the show and whatever it takes, you know.
I'm fascinated by all this, but how's everyone feeling? You want some more from Vince, like another 15, 20 minutes? Another question, this is from Ryan Doucette on Facebook. Vince, never mind the fact that this event is called One Last Cook. If you were given a barrel full of money and coerced into creating one more episode of Breaking Bad, where would you take the surviving characters? Ooh, this is, it's a trap, Vince. It's a trap. And what would be some
try,
of the...
Ryan.
Badger would be talking about Akbar right now. And what would be some of the significant events that might occur in their lives? No, Ryan. We're not falling for that.
Well played, Ryan.
Yeah. Well played. I was handed this card right before I came out, and I don't even know what this story is. But we do have one more super fan, I'm told. Super fan number 3, Raresh Demofte. I hope. Are you here? Are you here? Oh, wow. Come on down. Come on down, Raresh. Fantastic. Wow. Unbelievable. Can everybody see this fantastic gentleman in his tidy whities? Please. Take your time. Work it. Easy now.
That's pretty good.
He's almost there, guys. I can't wait to hear this. I'm not even going to ask you how long you've been watching the show. Because I'm terrified that you don't. Please, shoot, ask Vince anything.
Vince? Sorry, I don't have my gun. For the scene, I mean. Okay, here's my question. What was in your mind
yeah.
what was in your mind when you decided, okay, Walt has to be a bad guy from a good guy?
If I may translate.
I mean,
what was the defining moment when Walt, you know, what was the first line that he crossed, really? You know, when he...
Very good question.
Yeah, there was probably a moment...
Good team effort there before. Is that right?
Please, let it be right. Yes? He never unbuttoned his shirt that way. That's just...
Yeah, you're working that much more than Brian did. I think that's... I'm impressed. I like that.
I mean, my question comes... I mean, look at me. That's why I'm asking this question.
Yeah, right on.
Answer it, Vince, please.
I think, that's a very good question, I think the moment Walt became a bad guy was actually very early on. It was not the most dramatic moment of badness, but it was in the fourth episode of the first season. It was not, for instance, the moment where he watched Jane die or killed his first victim or whatever. I think it's the moment in the fourth episode of the first season where he gets offered, in Deus Ex Machina fashion, he gets offered an out, a way out of his problems, of his financial problems. And he is told by Gretchen and Elliot, those characters that we discussed earlier, he gets told that, you know, they're going to pay for his cancer treatment. They're going to make things right for him. They're going to make him financially solvent. And he instead says no, thank you. And out of what seems to be perverse pride and ego, he instead goes to Jesse and he says, "Hey, let's keep cooking meth." So I think that's the moment where that happens. Where did he go?
I'm a little concerned. Where did he go? Anyone with eyes on the net?
He'll be waiting in the car for us. Thank you, though. And that shows a great deal of... I appreciate the effort there. You look great.
I tweeted this earlier this week, but I figured I'd share it again here. It's a quote, and so just listen carefully. When King Lear dies in Act 5, do you know what Shakespeare has written? He's written, he dies. That's all, nothing more. No fanfare, no metaphor, no brilliant final words. The culmination of the most influential work of dramatic literature is, he dies. Do you know who said this quote, Vince, that I just read? The answer is Mr. McGorry. Mr. McGorry in the movie, Mr. McGorry's Wonder and Glory. Look it up, I shit you not. And from this stems two questions. How overtly is Breaking Bad Shakespearean? But is it intentional, is it non-intentional? Will you use words in the writer's room like Skyler is Lady Macbeth now, or this is his Lear moment, or his Hamlet moment, or you know, how cognitive? Obviously, Breaking Bad is a... I'm thinking probably not a comedy at this point, but you know, how intentional are the Shakespearean?
You know, I am not as brushed up on my Shakespeare as I should be. I've read Hamlet, Macbeth, and King Lear in high school. It's been a long time. I think Shakespeare, could be argued, is if not the foundation, one of the... you could count them on one hand, the three or four foundations of pretty much most of Western literature. I guess unless you're going to go back to Homer or whatever. But having said that, I think we sublimate a lot of this stuff. I can't point to the exact Shakespearean references that we may or may not be guilty of. And I have to say, I think more in terms of The Godfather with Breaking Bad. We always spoke about The Godfather, part one and part two, in the writer's room, and we would either say, how did Coppola do it in The Godfather, or we would be very proud of ourselves after having broken a particular scene.
Holy shit, Jesse, it's Fredo. It is, right?
Maybe. I mean, you know, sometimes we would break these, you know, it's a little free form sometimes. We would sometimes break a scene and then say, you know what, I think, you know, we're very proud of a scene we broke, and then we'd say, oh man, wait a minute, the Godfather's already done this, you know. By the way, I got to give a shout out to Zach Helm, writer and director of Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium, who we took a, I hope, a gentle and good-natured little shout out to in our last episode.
Did you see what he said?
I did. I never met him. He's like the coolest guy ever. And you know, really, I think what we liked about having that, you know, we meant no offense. It's just the name is so much fun to say. Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium. So I think we wanted to hear Walter White say Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium.
For those of you who, you know, Zach Helm, who wrote that and directed that movie, he was asked about the shout out in last week's episode. And he said that he just found it completely ridiculous and unbelievable because no one would own two copies. He himself does not even own one.
He's a very cool guy.
Very cool.
I haven't even met him, but I know that just from his what he said on Twitter or wherever it was. That was very cool.
I've just got a couple more questions for you, I did want to talk a little bit about this flash forward idea. The pilot sort of starts with a mini flash forward. Obviously, it starts with Walt's confession, and then we go back and see the sequence of events leading up to it. And then I could be wrong here. I haven't done my full rewatch yet, but I don't think you did it again until the beginning of season two, which opened with the bear in the pool, which was you know, sort of a seasonal flash forward. It was almost like
I think we did a little bit of it in the second to last episode of season one where Walt is saying, here's how it's going to be, we're not going to be violent, we're not going to be, but then we see the aftermath of blowing up two
cars. Right, yes, yeah, I stand correct. Yeah.
But we tried not to, you know, it's like salt on your french fries.
Right.
You want just the right amount. If you do too much, french fries don't taste good anymore. You want just the right amount of seasoning. So we tried not to rely on that bookended sort of circularity too often, but used it more sparingly.
But now, obviously, here we are approaching the end, and we have two, we've seen two flash forwards, one that began the first part of season five, and the other that was sort of a continuation of that. And it almost feels like, and I'm not asking you to betray it, but we're caught up. We can draw a straight line from the end of last week's episode, and those two scenes logically follow. I'm not saying that nothing comes in between, but so it feels like we are now in completely and totally uncharted territory in terms of where we can go. And I was just curious if you could talk a little bit about, you know, that Hitchcockian idea of showing the bomb under the table creates a certain degree of suspense. Now, you know, the suspense is played out and we're just into straight up, you know, explosion time. And how calculated was all that?
You know, it's one of the questions, so many questions you ask yourself when you're breaking these kind of stories, or when you're writing a movie script, or writing a novel, or play, or whatever. I mean, you ask yourself, how much pure surprise do we want versus how much tension and dread? And the two, I don't know if they're mutually exclusive, but tension and dread derive from the audience knowing, or at least suspecting, what's going to happen. Pure, unadulterated surprise comes from literally not being able to guess what happens next. And I'm jumping all around here. I'm trying to make a cogent point. This is going to sound like a weird aside, but I think about, I talk a lot about the final episode of one of my favorite TV shows ever, MASH. And MASH has implicit within its first episode, and indeed all of its episodes, the ingredients for that final episode. This is a show on its face. It's about a bunch of people who don't want to be where they are. They want to go home. And in the last episode, they go home. And there's nothing really surprising about the final episode of MASH. There's some wonderful little tricks.
Klinger stays.
Yeah, that's ironic. Okay, that is surprising. That is ironic. But it's not such a good final episode because it is full of twists and turns and surprises. Rather, it is satisfying, at least to me it was, because it's the thing that I wanted to see all along on some level. So we ask ourselves a lot in the writer's room, what constitutes the proper ending for this particular TV show? Every TV show, every movie, everything has got its own proper ending that you hope you can arrive at, you know, when you're plugging away on these things. So we ask ourselves a lot, is the best possible ending for Breaking Bad one of unadulterated surprise, or is it giving the audience something that they kind of expect? That feels fated. Is there a certain amount of destiny or fate that feels like it should take a hand? I'm not saying, by the way, I'm not telling you what we wound up arriving at. But these
and
are
George Masters said,
boom! And it blows up. But these are the kind of questions I'm sure you guys were asking. I mean, the trying to figure out how to end anything, any work of fiction, but, especially something that's gone on as long as a TV series. Man, it's just, there's so much you got to think about.
It's not easy, and I think I speak for all of us when I say we're absolutely sure that you're going to stick the landing. And I mean that with, you know, absolute certainty. So,
because
I know what I'm talking about. So, I want to talk a little bit about the end, because we're coming to the end of this chat, which has been incredible. As I mentioned at the beginning, we're about 72 hours away. Less than 48. Oh, right, it's Friday night. Oh my God. And millions of people are all kind of coming up with their predictions of how it all ends, how they want it to end, how it should end. This idea of inevitability that you just talked about. How aware are you of these theories that are out there of you know, and everybody who, even, you know, from the New York Times to the LA Times to Grantland is basically posting, here's what we think is going to happen on Breaking Bad. Are you tracking any of that?
I am not really. I hear, most of what I hear is anecdotal. I hear it from people I work with, friends, whatnot, who tell me what they've read on the internet. I shy away from reading about, I always have, reading about the show on the internet, not because I'm not interested, but because I'm too interested. I would disappear into internet land for many hours on end and probably not feel any better about myself afterward. I don't mean that we don't get a lot of lovely reactions and wonderful, thoughtful discussion of the show. It's just that, I don't know, I know my own, you know, mental makeup, emotional makeup. It's I don't know, it's like 1,000 good things are never enough and one bad thing just makes you want to slit your wrist. So it's silly, it's ridiculous, and it doesn't seem healthy, but there it is, and at least I'm honest about it. So having all that long-winded thing, I have heard some of these theories, and some of them are wonderful in their imaginativeness, and others maybe pretty close to the mark, and I'm not saying which one's which, but there's a lot of smart people out there, and it's very possible that somebody out there has already guessed some of the major plot points of this thing, but I'm not saying who.
What are you going to miss the most?
I already miss the family of the cast and crew the most, and that's been a feeling we've had now for a great many months, because We wrap production in early March, and that's when the crew all pretty much said goodbye to one another in Albuquerque. And then we had several months of post, so that we kept the post crew going in Burbank. And then we said goodbye to them, and it's been sad. Last night I had dinner with Mark Freeborn, another wonderful Canadian who lives up here. Girlfriend and I had dinner with Mark and his lovely wife Rose, and he is now a production designer on Bates Motel, which is an excellent show. It was bittersweet. We had such a good dinner, but the whole time I'm thinking, man, I miss this guy. I miss. I don't see these folks often enough now. So that's the answer. I miss the people. But I think we ended the show at the right time creatively. You guys be the judge 48 hours from now. But it's better to leave the party with folks wanting more rather than
I think that I can speak for most of the people in this room when I say I don't want it to end, but I'm ready for it to end. And that's really a testament to the amazing work that you and your team have done. And this kind of brings us to our last question. And it's the most, it's the most personal, but I do feel like, you know, for all these people who stood in line and bought tickets to see you here tonight, this is really the only opportunity that you'll have. You'll be asked many, many questions about this show subsequent to it over the years. It's your legacy, even if you go on to create other incredible shows. This show was so incredible that my guess is that it's going to be remembered for a very, very long time. But at this moment in time, right now, just 5 days ago, I'm bad with math, 5 days ago, you won the Emmy. You won the Drama Emmy. In typical, Vince fashion, although all of us were absolutely convinced that was the only outcome that should occur, you seemed really surprised and flustered and modest about it. And the first thing that you said when you got up there, you mentioned all the other shows and talked about the golden age of TV. And so that happened, and that's incredible. And there's still another season of eligibility, but it was a great celebration. And now here we are. 2 days away from the show ending. It's going to be over. There's never going to be another episode of Breaking Bad again. There will be Better Call Saul, but this story is ending. It's over. How do you feel right now? What are your feelings? Like, what's going on in your mind and in your heart? Like,
I'm thankful to all of you folks for showing up here. It's hard to get you. I'm trying to put it into words properly. It's hard to take it all in. I mean, I look out, I see 1,800 fans of this show that in the early days I did not think had a chance of going on the air. And then when it went on the air, I did not think it had a chance of lasting past maybe a season or two at the most. I did not foresee any of this coming. I didn't foresee the Emmy. And it's hard to take it all in. I'm trying to think of the right analogy, and I should be able to, because that's what I do for a living, is make up analogies. It fails me, I don't feel like I'm completely processing it, even though I've had several months now, a great many months, in fact, to process it. But I can't see the forest for the trees, but it's, I thank all of you for making this show a hit. You folks and folks all around the world who have embraced this show. We did it for ourselves. I'm not going to say we're not selfish, but we did it for you as much as we did it for us, because it's fun to make people happy, and it's fun to satisfy them. And I hope 48 hours from now we did just that, because it means the world to us to end this thing right and to stick the landing, as you say, and to satisfy the fans of the show who got us to this place. And it's just, I just want to thank you.
Well. How we feel is grateful for everything, for this amazing show that's been such a huge part of our lives. So everybody, one more time for Vince Gilligan.